ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
They prayed, they preached, they rebelled. From God Forbid, this is the Religious Rebels podcast. The stories of people who defied empires and sometimes paid with their lives. From Joan of Arc's battlefield visions to Malcolm X's final revelation, we tell the stories of those who defied faith and remade it. Religious Rebels, the original disruptors. Search for God Forbid ABC wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
This is The Book Show, where today I can promise you a killer granny, the ultimate second chance romance, and one of the tensest books I have read in 2025. I'm Claire Nichols. So great to be with you for The Book Show today, where the best-selling author Sally Hepworth is still to come with a story about a murderous granny. Comedian Alice Fraser will also join us to rave about Persuasion for our Jane Austen series, Dear Jane. But first, if you're looking for a book to get your heart rate up, I can highly recommend this. It's called A Guardian and a Thief, and it's by the Indian novelist Megha Majumdar. And the stakes for this novel, not only are they sky high, but they are completely laid out by the end of the first chapter. So we know there is a food crisis in near future Kolkata. Ma is robbing her own charity to feed her father and daughter. And in 7 days, they're flying to America as climate refugees. They just need to get through the next week. Megha, hi.
Hi, Claire.
So we know from the first page of this book that food is scarce. What has happened in your version of Kolkata?
In the novel, we are looking at a Kolkata which is in the future, which has been devastated by the effects of climate change. And one of those effects is that agriculture has been harmed and foods that are familiar to the people are vanishing. So the characters in this book, they go to the market looking for cauliflower, which one of them really loves. And instead of cauliflower, they find insect protein.
Wow. The thought of not being able to feed your family or feed yourself, it's so terrifying. Megha, what was it like for you to confront that idea?
I came to this book in part because I love food. I come from a family where we really care about food. You know, if you come back from a party or a wedding, one of the first questions is, what did you eat? And so the emotional texture of food is very present for me. I think a lot about the nourishing, comforting function of food. So I'm very curious about what happens to family life, what happens to togetherness when that is taken away.
And in the book, Ma reflects that this is not the first time that Kolkata has seen a food shortage. Is this something that has happened before in Kolkata?
There have been very mild instances. For example, when I was growing up, I remember a period of an onion shortage. Onions became really, really expensive. So there have been mild instances like that. But I think with climate change, one of the effects is going to be new pests, new kinds of regions in which these pests spread. Of course, the scarcity of water is going to affect agriculture, changing weather patterns will. So I think that a more widespread food shortage is not that improbable.
And Kolkata itself, is this a place that is particularly susceptible to the impacts of climate change?
It is. And this is such a place of sorrow for me. Kolkata is my hometown. I grew up there. Now I live in New York, but I lived in Kolkata until I was 19, and I started reading about how Kolkata is one of the cities in the world which is most severely affected by climate change. It has grown hotter over the past several decades. It is predicted to endure more storms and more severe storms. So thinking about the future of this place that I love was one of the avenues into this book for me.
Okay, so in this version of Kolkata, we meet Ma. Ma means mum, obviously. She lives with her two-year-old daughter, Mishti, and she also lives with her father. And you tell us in the first chapter, she just needs to survive the next 7 days. What a way to immediately put us on edge, Megha.
I appreciate that clock of the book worked for you. I worked so hard to figure out what is a length of time in which I can show great pressure on these characters and I can show great change, great transformation. Because one of the things that really drew me into this book was the question of moral dilemmas. What do you do when your love for your family clashes with your moral center? And I finally, after many, many failed drafts, I landed on this structure of 7 days where I can show how these characters change in astonishing ways.
Why 7 days? What's happening to this family in 7 days?
In the book, they are 7 days away from leaving India and migrating to the United States to join a family member who is already there, who is already in Michigan. And they have their climate visas. They are all set to leave. And then, of course, something goes very wrong.
Yeah, okay, so this idea of climate visas, this is really interesting. Climate visas do exist, actually. Australia was the first country in the world to offer climate visas to the people from Tuvalu. Do you think this is something we're going to see more of in the world?
I believe so. I believe so. And I think the really frightening aspect of it will be the question of what is a safe haven? I don't think there will be any place in the world which will be untouched by the effects of climate change. And we will see how people in different regions are affected differently, and people of different classes and different resources are affected differently. So questions of who deserves safety? Who deserves escape? What does escape look like for different people? I think these questions will become very urgent.
That's something that kept coming up for me. Who gets a climate visa, right? Because it's a nice idea offering a safe haven somewhere else, but it's only going to affect a handful of people. The majority are going to be left behind.
Yes, absolutely. And class is one of the things that I wanted to think through in this book. The characters that we've talked about so far, the mother and her family, they're a middle-class family. There's also the character of a villager who is struggling to find a foothold in the city, and he's quite poor. And then there's also a billionaire in the city for whom climate change represents not only crisis, but also an opportunity. This billionaire is curious about opportunities for political gain and profit that might come her way if she persists. So I was very curious about how the devastation of climate change will actually mean quite different things for different people.
It's kind of terrifying to think that climate change can mean opportunity.
Yes, I was very interested in the complexity of people. I think that is one of the most beautiful, invigorating things that fiction can do, is show us how other people are as complex as we are. And the billionaire in this book, she is interested in opportunities for profit, but she is also interested in the well-being of the children of the city. So both of those things are true.
Mm-hmm. I want to stick with Ma for just a moment longer, though, because I said in the introduction, she's the manager of a homeless shelter, and we find out in that first chapter, and I think the first two pages, that she's also been taking food from this shelter to feed her own family. This is wonderfully murky ethical territory, Mega. Talk to us about, I guess, the ethical dilemma that this woman has found herself in.
I'm so glad that that spoke to you, because I never wanted to write a book which has a noble mother and a villainous thief. And I was very interested in what happens if we show how each of us really contains the capacity to act in immoral ways. Given circumstances of scarcity and crisis, how closely would we cling to our morals? What would we surrender? What would we sacrifice? And especially think about the ferocity of love that we have for our children. In a crisis, what will we do for our children? It's a frightening question.
And it's certainly one that you're getting us to ask ourselves as we read this book. I think, you know, this central premise of Ma stealing the food from the shelter to feed her family really kind of underpins the big ideas in this book. You know, would you hurt someone else to feed your child? What makes your child more human to you than another human in need? It's so fascinating. Do you remember when this came to you, this kind of central theme to the book?
What's fascinating when I think about this is that for a long time, I struggled to make a different plot work, where in this novel, I had the near future Kolkata, I had the climate crisis, but I was trying to follow a completely other character of a 10 or 11 year old girl, and it just wasn't working. I couldn't make those drafts work. And then I had my older son, and I became so interested in this character's mother. I thought, who is this girl's mother? What will she do in this crisis? And that's really what led me to this character.
So as your own parenthood that kind of influenced the direction of the novel?
Absolutely. You know, what's really funny is that becoming a parent slowed me down. It took me 6 years to write this book, but I think in really vital ways, it made me the writer I needed to be to write this book.
Wow, that is so cool. So you've mentioned another key character in this book. He's a boy called Boomba. He's a resident of the shelter where Ma has been working and stealing from. And he robs Ma. He steals her bag, and it's got those precious passports and visas inside. Introduce us to this boy, Boomba.
Boomba is a villager. He lives in a small village outside of Kolkata. He belongs to a really poor family. He's a boy full of dreams. He's a boy who loves his younger brother, and he does everything possible to help his family. And then he commits a great mistake, which he feels that he has to correct. And his way of trying to correct it is to go to the city, find a job, find a safe house, and bring his family over. And that is his journey, which brings him into collision with Ma's journey.
I love that. Both characters are guardians and both characters are thieves. That is so clever, Mega. It must have been a nice moment when you figured that out.
It felt like a moment of arriving at something truthful. You know, the beauty of writing fiction is that you conjure all of these people and you make up all of these situations. And the purpose of all of it is to arrive at the truth.
Our character Boomba, he's got this little brother, Robbie. Can you just tell us a little bit about the relationship between Boomba and this little boy?
Boomba is so much older than his little brother, Robbie, that he is almost like a parent. He's often left alone to take care of his little brother while their parents are away working or seeking work. And he is a young man who feels a great deal, not only of love, but of responsibility for this little boy. He feels that he is in some way responsible for securing this little boy's future. And I wanted to show two kinds of guardian relationships. One is of a mother and her child, and the other is of an older sibling and a younger sibling.
So this book, we've outlined, you know, you've got this 7-day structure. We've got this crisis that's escalating between Ma and Boomba. Boomba has the passports that Ma wants. Ma has the house that Boomba wants. And it builds and it builds and it builds. Did you always know, Mega, how this novel would end?
I knew that the intensity of the journey of both characters would need to lead to a kind of explosive end. And it took me a while to work out the details of it. My editor actually really helped me finesse the ending. But I always know the emotional landing note of my novels because they help me orient my work. They are kind of the guiding light for the rest of the novel.
And we can't talk about what that ending is, but I would recommend to listeners, when you go and pick up a copy of A Guardian and a Thief, get a copy for a friend too, because this is an ending you are going to need to talk to somebody about immediately. I want to talk a little bit about the world building in this novel, Mega Majumdar. It is a near future Kolkata. We've talked about this food crisis. There's a robot dog that appears at one point in the novel, but other than that, it seems to be a world very, very close to our own. What kind of parameters were you setting for yourself when you were allowing yourself to imagine this future Kolkata?
I was very interested in having small hints of the near future, like the robot dogs that you mentioned. There's a mention of birds dropping from the sky because it's so hot and they're so exhausted. There's a mention of shoes sticking to the melting tar of the road because it's so hot. There's a mention of people agitating for the right to shade from the sun. So I wanted to conjure these details of this near future world. And the really interesting thing is that after building out these details, I then needed to suppress them within this world to let the characters shine. Because when we are reading a book, we don't really feel anything for the details of the world. We care about the people, the characters. So I had to do this delicate balancing act of building a convincing world and then burying it a little bit within the book so that the characters could shine.
And a character we haven't mentioned is Ma's father. He's known as Dadu. He's a man who is totally in love with his city, the city of Kolkata. Can you explain his relationship to this place?
Dadu, the grandfather, represents an aspect of the immigrant's relationship with their hometown. I think anybody who is living far from home might recognize the way in which Dadu feels that he is so in love with his hometown, he will never again be able to be his full self in another place. He feels afraid that he is leaving behind his best self, his most authentic self in this hometown. And his love for the city is incredibly true, just as Ma's excitement for leaving the city is true. In writing this book, I was quite interested in this duality that I think every immigrant holds, this mix of love for the place that you are leaving and nostalgia and sorrow that you are leaving it, and a sense of joy and accomplishment that you are building a new life in a new place.
And I'm sure this is something you recognize in yourself too. You grew up in Kolkata, but you spent most of your adult life in America, as I understand. Like, what's your relationship like with home?
It's a very intricate relationship that I think through. You're right, I lived in Kolkata until I was 19, and now I have lived in the US and I'm 38, so I have spent half my life here and half my life there. And I think that in recent years, I have really come to face that immigration is a wound for me. It's a wound. It's a place of grief and sorrow. But at the same time, it's also true that I'm very happy with my life here, and I feel very free and very myself here. So both of those things are true. And I think that place where we recognize multiple truths, even contradictory truths, I think that is a very rich place for fiction.
I recently read a memoir by an Australian novelist, Hannah Kent, called Always Home, Always Homesick. And I think that certainly is something that sums up that experience, right? You're always happy with where you were, but you're always missing where you've been.
That's a fantastic title. I will have to look up that book.
It's pretty cool. The other thing, I guess, about living, you know, spending half your life in America is, how does that distance help you to write about your home city?
From this distance, I feel that I can see what I most love about Kolkata. One of the things, for example, is the sense of humor that people have in Kolkata. People are so funny, even through daily problems. And especially when facing daily problems, people respond with jokes and laughter. And I think that that laughter is a form of resilience. So I was very interested in this book in showing how people laugh in the face of the climate crisis. They joke. Another thing that is so important in this city are the networks of reliance and dependence. Even when you are very thinly connected to other people, even when your connection is to your cousins, neighbors, teachers, friend, you can still activate that relationship and say, hey, I need help. I need a place to stay. I need advice on something. And people respond. People respond with generosity and help. And those relationships are so much part of what makes the city so strong and resilient. And I wanted to have those elements in the book.
Yeah, they're certainly very present. You've told me about, you know, starting this book and writing a completely different novel, then finally finding the story you wanted to tell, finding that 7-day structure. When you look back, was there one challenge with this novel that stood out above all others?
What I found very difficult in writing this novel was I often felt that my vision for what I wanted to create exceeded my skill as a writer. I wanted to write something more beautiful, more truthful, more complex. The plot changed so many times. I wrote hundreds of pages that I threw away. I wrote a friend character who was no longer in the book. I wrote a scene about a hotel being robbed, which is no longer in the book. I wrote pages about a vertical farm and threw them out. And all of those were moments of failure. And, you know, one thing that I'll say to anybody who is a creative person listening to this is that I used to think that those moments of failure are obstacles, but now I really think that they are guiding lights. They are moments of courage, which encourage us to say, I can do better. This is not good enough. I'm going to do better.
And who knows, maybe that vertical farm can appear in the next book.
You're right. You are so right. Nothing is ever wasted.
Hey, Megan Majumdar, congratulations on this book. I thought it was fantastic. It's called A Guardian and a Thief. It's published by Scribner. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Claire. This is so special.
On ABC Radio National, you're listening to The Book Show, where now it's time for a touch of murder.
It is interesting to note that there are two groups of people who are rarely, if ever, suspected of murder. These groups are elderly women and little girls. On the whole, when it comes to murder, the stats very much favour the men. The odd woman is thrown into the mix every now and then, but she's inevitably perimenopausal. And having been through the change myself, I certainly understand why. But an elderly woman or a little girl committing murder? It's one in a million. I've always liked to think I was special.
That's the start of Mad Mabel by Sally Hepworth. Sally is a hugely popular writer known for her twisty commercial fiction. And this new book, it's her 10th, and put simply, it is about a granny serial killer. Of course, there's a lot more to it than that. It's about loneliness, neglect, and female friendship. And it's all centred around Mabel, a tough-as-nails 81-year-old who might have a heart of gold. Sally Hepworth, welcome.
Oh, thank you. What a lovely introduction.
10 books in 10 years is amazing, Sally. How on earth do you write 10 books in 10 years?
Oh, look, it does sound impressive when you say it like that, but if you saw the state of my household and, you know, the varying states of my children at any particular time, then you might understand why I have enough time to do that.
So does it follow like a calendar year? I mean, is it quite specific in the way you work?
It does. It does. It sort of will take me about 6 months to write the book, and then there's a bit of editing and a bit of touring and all of that in there that kind of makes up a calendar year, but it works for me because it means that it's almost like having a different job every year because I've got new work colleagues / characters that I'm dealing with and you know, something new to talk about. So I really like the kind of flow of it for a book a year.
And is there always the next idea sitting there ready to go?
No, that sounds much more organised than it actually is. Sometimes the idea is waiting for me. Sometimes it's been bothering me for a little while, you know, and something I've thought about for a while, and then I just kind of managed to put it together. Other times I finish a book and I've got no idea what's coming next, and it's sort of a bit of trust and opening myself up to the possibility, and with Mad Mabel, the idea was literally delivered to me when I was promoting the book before. So that was ideal, but it doesn't always work out for me like that.
Okay, so tell me about that. Tell me how this idea came to you.
Well, I was at an event talking about my previous book, Darling Girls, and I had, as I normally do during my events, I talked quite a lot about family members and murder and how we do quite often want to murder them and you know, the different ways we might do that. And at the end of the event, I noticed there was an elderly lady waiting to speak to me, and she was right at the end, and she waited and waited, came up to the front, pulled up a chair, which was my first that was my first indication that something interesting was coming. And she sat down and she said, I've been thinking about murdering my next door neighbour. And I said, oh, right, so how are you going to do it? You know, because I'm always looking for ideas. And she said, well, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I know that I'm going to get away with it. And I said, oh, well, how do you know that you're going to get away with it? And she said, because there's two groups of people who are never suspected of murder, and those are old women and little girls. And I knew then, as you can hear in my prologue, that that's what my next book was going to be about.
I love that someone said to you, Sally, I'm thinking of murdering my neighbour. And you, instead of saying, don't do it, I'm going to call the police, said, oh, yeah? Tell me your idea.
Yeah. I mean, look, I've lived long enough now, and she certainly had lived long enough to know that sometimes murder is necessary, especially with your neighbour.
OK, Okay, so in this novel, Mabel is 81 and she's famous. Why is Mad Mabel, as she's known, so famous?
Well, Mad Mabel, infamous probably rather than anything else, because Mad Mabel was the name of the woman at this particular time who was the youngest ever to be convicted of murder in Australia. It's fictional. So everyone in Melbourne, in Australia, knew Mad Mabel in the same way that, you know, we know some infamous criminals' names. But she had changed her name and she had, lived a fairly ordinary life ever since being 15, and she wanted it that way. But at the beginning of the book, when her nemesis neighbour Ishan is, you know, dies, not really under suspicious circumstances, it has to be said. He was 93 years old, but when he dies and it's discovered that Elsie is Mad Mabel, people start to suspect that, in fact, she maybe had something more to do with Ishan's death than what originally it seems.
There's not just one person that dies in Mabel's life. A lot of people in Mabel's life end up dying. We can't say who, we can't say how, because it's going to give the story away. But this kind of tagline of a story about a granny serial killer, I mean, it does have juice, right? Can you tell me about unlocking that and how exciting it was?
Oh my gosh. As soon as I heard this woman say it to me, I thought, wow, that is so true. The idea of a, you know, there are some female killers and usually though you will find that they're associated with, you know, there's a man at the heart of it, you know, and even fewer you'll find little girls. And I did do some research. Mary Bell was one very young murderer in the UK, and then there were also the cases of Juliet Hume and Pauline Parker, who were the youngest murderers in New Zealand, and there was a film made about them, Heavenly Creatures, I think about 10 years ago with Kate Winslet. Both of them are rare, but I mean, just I was salivating at the opportunity of writing about either of those, because it's so rare that you can find an idea that, even if it has been done before but hasn't been done a lot, that's such an exciting thing for an author. And I just, what a rich vein to tap, not just the elderly woman but also the little girl as well.
So we go back to Mabel's childhood and we learn what really happened to her when she was a kid. I think it's important to note that as a child, Mabel, I think she's just about the loneliest girl in the world. What can you tell us about this child?
Well, she is called Mad Mabel even before she was a convicted murderer, and she doesn't really know why. There's a scene early in the book where her mother overhears one of the neighbourhood children calling her Mad Mabel, and she's about five, and she asks her, why are you called Mad Mabel? And she says, I don't know. I've never questioned it. That's just what people call me. And she had been so desperate to have friends. You know, she'd been brought around other kids, but she'd been shunned, as it were. She also really wanted a closeness with both of her parents, which she didn't have for various reasons. And so she kind of was forced to look within. And, you know, everyone needs to find companionship and acceptance and love. And I think that's what Mabel / Elsie, as she's known later in her life, you know, has spent her whole life looking for.
So this is a book, Mad Mabel, that really relies on twists and turns to keep us turning the pages, Sally. How much do you know going in? Do you know the twists? Do you know the truth of Mabel's life before you get started?
No. Look, I mean, I've written 10 books now, so each one's been slightly different. I usually go in having an idea of what I think or where I think the book is going. I don't always, in fact, I very rarely stick with that path, because it is a little bit of a case of, you know, driving in the dark. You can only see as far as the headlights show you, you know, but then when you get to the headlights, you know the next bit. And I think that one of the bigger twists in the book, it came to me about halfway through, and I continued writing to that, knowing I would have to kind of go back and make some edits to make that work. And, you know, that's often how it happens. But then, you know, equally with other books, I've got to the end and thought, no, that doesn't work. I have to come up with something else, or I haven't had a twist at all. And then on the last page, it's come to me. So it's a little bit of trusting the process and hoping that something comes. I hadn't even known until a couple of books ago that twists were my thing, and until a reader came up and said, are you nervous that you're never going to come up with another twist again? And I said, well, now I am. I didn't realise that was what I was doing, but, you know, they do usually reveal themselves after a while.
Tell me about that moment, though, when the twist does come to you and you figure it out. Like, what does that feel like?
It's rarely the kind of joyful punching the sky moment. It's usually a kind of holding your breath moment where you think, oh, I think this might be it. And then a wild thinking back of all the ways that it may not work, you know, like, is this going to work? And you're just sort of slowly going through all the plot lines and the theme. Like, thematically is really important, because you don't just want to sort of plop something in because it's a great twist. Like, it's got to work with the rest of the book, and ideally it has to add a whole other layer to it and really make the book sing. So that's what you're looking for. So it can often be, oh, I think this is it, but then there's tweaking. And yeah, unfortunately, I wish it was a moment of triumph where I'm just, you know, cracking the champagne, but it's probably not until I actually get the book over to my publisher and they say, oh, that twist was epic, that I'm really kind of exhaling.
Right. Can we go back to the beginning, Sally? How did you find your way to writing?
Well, look, I mean, it's so boring, isn't it? I think every writer says it, but I did always want to write a book. I always was a reader. I always made up stories before I could even read. I used to make up the stories for the picture books that I had, you know, because I couldn't read the words, and I'd come up with a story that, you know, my mum always said, obviously they're not always the best judge, but were much better than the stories that were actually written.
Thanks, Mum.
Thanks, Mum. And creative writing was always something that, I guess, as a kid, I noticed that I was told that I was good at. I think that's a really important thing to make someone, and I wasn't a kid that was particularly good at a lot of things. I wasn't, you know, that you know, academically super successful kid or good at sport or anything like that. And so I paid attention when teachers said, you know, your story was great, or you've got a great imagination. And I, of course, wanted to develop that. And I kept hearing that throughout my life. And when I was 29 and on maternity leave and found myself with little pockets of time, I thought, well, why don't I just give this a crack and see if I can write a book? And I, you know, I did write a book that year, but it was, you know, a terrible book, and it didn't end up being published. But it made me realize that, yeah, this is what I want to do. And yes, I think while this book isn't good enough, I think that I could, you know, commit to really trying my best to make this my career.
And, you know, we were talking at the start of the chat, Sally, about the calendar year of writing, getting a novel out every year. Does that mean the next book is already in progress?
Yes. Yep. I'm about halfway through next year's book at the moment. And as soon as I'm just about finishing up on my Australian tour commitments for Mad Mabel, and then it'll be full steam ahead on that one until I go on my American tour in April. So yes, I'm about to really put my head down and get that one out, which is my favourite part. It's still, after 10 books, it's my favourite part is getting those stories out.
Well, it's a real pleasure to chat to you today, Sally. Your latest book is called Mad Mabel. I really, really enjoyed it, and it's published by Macmillan. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. I loved it.
Here on The Book Show, we're celebrating the 250th anniversary of Jane Austen. So far, we've busted some myths and revealed why Austen loves sailors. You can find our previous episodes on the ABC Listen app. Just look for Dear Jane. Today, Sarah Lestrange and I are focusing on the romance in Jane Austen, with persuasion and the art of the long game. Sarah,
I think it's time we talk about romance.
Absolutely, because that is one of the reasons we love Austen's books so much. Mm-hmm. We know that by the end of the book, her hero and heroine, well, they'll be mutually joined in affection, but also in bank balance.
It's funny that, isn't it? The right man always happens to be a pretty well-off man in the Austen novels.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're right. The love stories in Austen's novels, they're wonderful. Well, mostly wonderful. Like, you know, I have a bee in my bonnet about a few of them, but they are one of the main reasons that readers keep coming back.
And it's something that the Australian comedian Alice Fraser, she loves it too. And she's even written a book about romance called A Passion for Passion. And Alice is joining us from the romance capital of the Sunshine Coast in Queensland. Alice, when were you introduced to Jane Austen?
Jane Austen came into my life probably very early. My mum used to watch the BBC Jane Austens, and so I started reading them at about the time that mum started watching them, because she was a big believer that you ought to read the book first. So I would read the book, and then we would be allowed to watch whatever it was, the BBC Pride and Prejudice or the Persuasion with Kieran Hines as Captain Wentworth, and those made kind of a profound impact on me.
Okay, so we talk about Jane Austen as a romance writer, but I'm keen to know what romance meant to Jane Austen.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really good question, because while we might have tension and giddiness that you associate with love stories in her work, they're all grounded in this idea that marriage is the ultimate outcome, whereas, I don't know, these days, is marriage the end goal?
Yeah, well, that's questionable. I mean, these matches in Austen's novels, they're sensible matches. Everyone will be better off for these matches. But, of course, there is love there too.
Yeah, she's not completely breaking expectations.
Yeah.
But, Claire, how do you feel about the book Persuasion?
I like Persuasion. This is, of course, about Anne Elliot and Captain Wentworth. It's a bit more sombre, more autumnal than Emma and Pride and Prejudice. I think it feels like Austen for grown-ups.
Yes, autumnal. That's a beautiful use of the word. I think it really shows the range of Jane Austen's writing, don't you? You know, it's not just comedy and misunderstanding.
Yeah, and I think this is a really great book to focus on as we talk about romance in Austen today, Sarah, because the love story between Anne Elliot and Captain Wentworth, it really is unique.
It is, Claire. It is unique. And I think Alice Fraser would agree. Alice, what makes it so different from Austen's other books?
It's what they would call now, in romance parlance, a second chance romance, which are immensely popular in the current market, but were not really a thing at the time that Jane Austen was writing and sort of bringing the genre out into the world for the first time.
So give us the background, Alice, the background to Persuasion, and why is this a second chance romance?
Anne has decided 8 years prior to the action, she's decided to break off her engagement with Captain Wentworth. When they were in love with one another and he didn't have many prospects, he was not as wealthy as he could have been, he wasn't as noble a family as her family and friends might have thought she was entitled to. You know, one of the reasons that this kind of period is so fruitful for romance novels is because you have simultaneously an idea of a love match emerging, but you also have the idea that particularly for people of nobility, marriage is about duty and is about kind of getting your family the best deal that they can get, and that you are, to a certain extent, an asset, and that your actions then reciprocally reflect on your family's social and financial opportunities. So the military in Persuasion and in many of these kind of books serves as a sort of a third branch where you have social mobility in a way that you would never otherwise have, that people are of one class or another and one ought to marry inside one class, ideally marry slightly up towards the top of your class or into the class above if you're a woman, but definitely you don't marry down. And so Captain Wentworth goes off and earns rank and money and becomes a prospect in a way that her family, you know, there's this feeling that they ought to have given him the benefit of the doubt because he's such a good man, but that they couldn't see past his social class to his virtues, and that they pressured Anne into refusing him, and that her duty to her family overrode her own feelings.
Ah, yes, the original second chance romance, which suits Anne Elliot's character because she is 27 and in those times that was ancient. And we meet her at this age and she really doesn't rush into things. She's the anchor for so many and she's surrounded by all these wishy-washy characters like her silly father and sister. Alice, why do you like this character so much?
She's Jane Austen's most introspective heroine, I think. She's intelligent, she's empathetic, and she swallows a lot of crap. She looks after the people around her, and she is concerned with the well-being of the people around her. She's not a traditionally kind of heroic. She's not, you know, sassy and witty like other characters. She's not going to clap back like Elizabeth Bennet, but she has this dignity and integrity that marks her. And I think more than many other books, we fall in love with her as Captain Wentworth falls back in love with her. And that the sense of her as a grown woman, not as a, you know, debutante, not as a teenager, that perhaps this version of her is more attractive than the young version of her. So she has this quiet dignity, but she also has a sense of humour. She's a keen observer of human nature. You see her mediating conflicts. She's gracious. She's delicate of the sensitive feelings of the idiots around her. But the journey in the book is from her point of view. She reclaims her agency. She goes from passive resignation to asserting her own desires, to going after the thing that she wants.
On the Book Show, we're celebrating 250 years of Jane Austen with me, Claire Nichols.
And me, Sarah Lestrange, with comedian Alice Fraser, who's getting serious today and is taking us through what makes Persuasion so special as a romance. This book that was published after Jane Austen died in 1817, along with Northanger Abbey.
So the thing is, Anne Elliot wants this match with Captain Wentworth. It didn't work out the first time, but now circumstances have changed. And we've learned that in this book, love isn't enough to make a lasting match. You have to have security and money too. Mm. And this is interesting, Sarah, because the character of Mrs. Smith, who's a widow and Anne's school friend, she shows us what can happen when wealth is frittered away.
Yeah, she's really the cautionary tale, isn't she?
Mm-mm.
So, Alice, what do you think? Did Anne make the right decision in rejecting Wentworth when she was younger?
It's a really interesting question because she isn't presented as having made the wrong decision. She made the right decision for the time, even though from our modern lens, you know, it's a ridiculous thing to say she should have listened to her family over her own heart. But at the time, you have to think about a society in which people relied much more on their families, in which you didn't have a society that would have a social safety net for an unmarried spinster. And we encounter that in Persuasion when she goes back and meets Mrs. Smith. She goes back and meets Mrs. Smith, who is in just a terrible way, doesn't have money to look after herself, is ill and ailing and hasn't got that support network of a family and wealth. And so certainly with Lady Russell, there is more respectful and in-depth discussions about love and duty. She's her godmother. She was a very good friend of Anne's mother and sort of stepped into a position of in loco parentis to some extent after her mother died and was probably one of the only sensible people in Anne's life when confronted with her very silly father and her very silly sister. We get the feeling that Lady Russell had sort of an outsized influence on the decision that Anne made, using to some extent the leverage of her mother would have wanted better for her than to marry a penniless officer. And Anne was allows herself to be persuaded. But you can see by the contrast of Lady Russell's depiction, you know, if her father and sister had argued against her marrying Captain Wentworth, it might not have been enough. But Lady Russell is in this position of being sensible, sane, loving, but invested in social structures and social norms more than you can be when you're very young. And so Anne has gone, well, I've got to take, I have to be persuaded by the wise, older, loving lady. So, yeah, I think that's a really interesting feature of this, that you get to see the arguments laid out and the fears that Lady Russell has for Anne that are pretty persuasive, actually.
So Anne and Wentworth start spending time together again, and of course they misunderstand their intentions and their expectations.
But I wish I could write a letter like Wentworth when he explains his position on love to Anne. Alice, it's just so beautiful.
The letter, "You pierce my soul, I'm half agony, half hope," is really lovely. Her argument basically is that women love longest when all hope is lost, that men can love very truly, but when the hope is over, they will move on. But that there's something about women that means you'll stick with a hopeless case. And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I'm not sure. In this context, of course, it's a good thing because Wentworth does still love her even after all hope is lost. Or maybe he just maintains hope longer than she does. The modern epistolary romance would be carried out in WhatsApps and tweets and probably involve some rude pictures. But wooing people with beautiful language, I think, is part of what's going on in Persuasion particularly. There is a sort of an emphasis on these conversations and arguments where you see one point of view laid up against the other point of view and they both have something to them. He starts off obviously resenting Anne for breaking his heart, and it's only in seeing her in relation to others and the ways in which she looks after the people around her that he evolves to recognize that these are qualities that he loves in her. And it is a question, I think, for the reader as to whether the conversation that she has in front of Captain Wentworth about the nature of lost love, whether that's a decision that she's making to open her heart to him again and give him the opportunity to write that letter. I don't think that question is answered in the text, but I think it's an interesting one for the reader.
I would love someone to tell me that I pierce their soul, Sarah Lestrange. This is such a good letter.
Yes.
I also love the line, "I offer myself to you again with a heart even more your own than when you almost broke it."
Oh, it's so swoony, but it's so excellent, isn't it? The writing is just exquisite. And this is one of the reasons Jane Austen is beloved by not just readers, but by writers too, because they can learn so much from her craft. Alice Fraser, as a comedian and a writer, what have you learnt from Jane Austen?
I think that so much of the comedy in Jane Austen comes from her lightness of touch, that she's not saying directly that these people are silly or ridiculous or even that these people are miserable or have made the wrong decisions. She's letting the reader deduce that by presenting the scenario and presenting these people often in dialogue with one another. Her way with dialogue is sort of extraordinary because you see in the way that people speak so much their character. You know, the characters, for example, that speak in complete sentences versus the ones who speak in broken thoughts and half sentences and sort of haphazard thinking. It shows you the character so well. So I think in terms of my own comedy, trying not necessarily to be like, this is what's funny about this, but to just lay it out for people to come themselves to the comedy, to come to the joke themselves, I think is the thing that I enjoy the most.
She is still teaching us all so much. Thank you, Alice Fraser.
Thank you.
And thank you, Sarah Lestrange.
It's always so great to talk about Jane with you, Claire. And next time it's all about Jane Austen as a global phenomenon with Laleen Sequeira, who grew up reading Austen in Pakistan.
And Sarah, in the words of Jane Austen, next time, I must speak to you by such means as are within my reach. I think that means we'll use a radio studio.
Good plan. Happy birthday, dear Jane.
That's the book show for today. Thanks to producer Sarah Lestrange and to operator David LeMay. We make this program on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people. Next time, the always entertaining Jeanette Winterson will be here to talk about technology, AI and storytelling. Until then, happy reading.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.